Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. I'm very excited tonight. This is a great show. I've been looking forward for this for a while. My guest tonight is Mark Bonilla, and I've known about him and followed him for years, and in a minute, I'm going to play the first clip that I heard of him, which from his first album. But first, I want to welcome you, Mark. It's an honor to have you here on the show. This is great.
No, it's always a pleasure to be here. And once I get on mic,
you should be on.
Yeah.
Hold on. Let me get.
Is
it?
No, not yet.
Huh.
Should I go to another mic?
No, it should be. Hold on 1 second here.
All right.
Hold on 1 second here. It's dead.
Jim.
It's dead, Jim. Hold on, let me go to...
on microphone, Jim.
Let's go to 8.
Okay, there we go.
All right.
There it was.
I got a bad input. Sorry.
That's okay. So, yes, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. But before we do anything, you have to talk about this guitar you brought in. It's just an amazing, and the story behind it. I took a bunch of pictures, and I'll post them. You got it. It's just an interesting, I'll just let you talk about it.
Well, I'm a big comic nerd. I still got all my comics boarded and bagged, and I think I got this in 93, Leo Knapp was working at Yamaha, and Ken DePron had come to me and said, hey, we want to make you another a Pacifica. What would you like? What kind of a paint job would you like on it? I lived like 15 feet from the store, the custom shop. And so I would go down there, and I chose the wood and did all that. And I said, you know what I'd really like is I'd like to have some of my early influences on there. So I dug out all my comics, and I found the pictures, like the guys that really drew the Jack Kirby stuff, the John Romita, the Jim Steranko, all the great artists. And I called Marvel, and I asked them to what aniline dyes that they used, and they were very suspicious, but they finally consented to tell me. And so I went home and I drew each one individually, and then they inset them into the guitar. So I've got all the heroes, going around the entire body of the guitar. Mm-hmm. And then the fretboard are all the things that you got when you open up the first page. The left-hand side of the page had everything you used to order, whether it was X-ray specs, whether it was Super Spy Scope, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. You see the X-ray hand, and then there was always the girl in shock behind there, because that's really what you were looking for, is the X-ray specs that would see through the dress.
Yes, see through the dress.
So I took all of those and scanned all of the actual drawings and inset them into the fretboard. So that's what all the fret dots are, the things you used to send away for.
That's great. Yeah. And they did all the inlay for that?
Yeah, they did all of that. It was actually a piece of reflective pearl, then the acetate of the drawing, and then they put lighting gels, and then they epoxied it. Mm-hmm. So that's why you get a backlight. Looks like it's lit.
It's a beautiful guitar. And then also, too, what are those any special pickups, or are they the Yamaha pickups?
It's a Seymour Duncan pickup, and then a special Yamaha single coil pickup in the front. And then there was a coil cut that actually Ronnie Montrose designed that I had incorporated into that guitar that he put in there. So I can get a lot of different attenuations with it. It's kind of like an elongated wah that you can,
You
can kind of peel back certain frequencies like a notch filter.
Well, let me play the first thing that I had heard, and we're going to use as our opening cut. This was from your first solo album, Double E Ticket.
Yeah.
And I forgot who told me about this album, but they said, you got to hear this, and they played this for me, and I just...
It's probably my mom.
Yeah. But anyway, you'll see what I'm talking about, but it's definitely, it opened my ears. But here it is. This is called White Noise.
Yeah, hold on a minute.
Now, you have to listen really carefully because he picked up his guitar and started playing it, and I just pulled it up in the mix. So there's actually an extra guitar on there, and that's him playing live to the track. That when I heard that, I'm like, I woke up.
Did you?
It's like, yes, yeah. this is very good. And that's when I first heard you. Anyway, it's a great album, and I recommend it. It's called Double E Ticket, and it's available. But tell us a little bit about your background and a little bit about where your influences came.
Well, I grew up in Walnut Creek, California. That's where I grew up. It was a very Leave It to Beaver type of town. And so I was in my first band, Rock Island, in high school. And it was great. We were together 10 years. And we did an unusual amount of original stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I started to want to get into the more progressive stuff because at that point, after the Beatles, this was towards the early 70s, I started getting into ELP, Yes, Gentle Giant, bands of that nature, Focus. I was a huge Focus fan, mm-hmm. big Jan Ackerman fan. And, so I wanted to seek out some other players, to try and do that. But I wasn't really finding any luck up in the Bay Area. So... I played for different bands, just club, just to get my chops up. And we had a band called JC and the Twisters, which was something we did in San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
It was a three-piece. And we never rehearsed. We just went there and says, what do you want to hear? We even tried, Bohemian Rhapsody. We were fearless. It sucked, but it was honest. All right, so we would do it, And at that point, that's when I met Keith. Keith Emerson, he walked into... the club while I was playing down there, playing White Noise, because I had just worked it, because Ronnie Montrose and I were kind of working together a lot. And he really is my mentor. He financed my first demo that became Double E Ticket, and he helped me write a lot of the stuff. You know, some of the opening riff was his idea, because that riff was somewhere in the middle of the song where, you know, and he said, no, you got to put that at the beginning of the song. You got to open up and tear someone's face off with it. So he was the one that suggested me put that at the beginning. So we're playing this, right? And here this guy walks in at the back of the pub, you know, and I was like, that guy looks like Keith Emerson. What the hell? Not Keith Emerson. So we finish playing, and he comes up, and I notice that it is Keith Emerson, you know, and he comes up and he introduces him, you know, and I'm kind of in shock, and he goes, what was that last tune you played? And I said, well, it was called White Noise. And he goes, yeah, it's good, that. Is you going to record it? And I said, yeah. And he goes, do you mind if I play piano on it? And I'm just looking at it. So the only thing I could think to say was, well, what have you done? Then that's what I did. I asked him what he'd done as a joke, right? And he goes, well, I was in a band called The Nice, and then I was in a band called EOP, you know. And I was like, no, Keith, that's a joke. You know, I have posters of you in my bedroom, right, that are only party to me and you. So at that point, I met Kevin Gilbert, because Kevin was producing Keith in town. Mm-hmm. And so Kevin and I got together at that point and really created a big bond. I think primarily because of our love for the Monkees. We're huge Monkees fans. And he never wanted to admit it to anybody, and I never did either at that point. But we were closet Monkee fans, right? Mm-hmm. So we got a great bond that way. And then I ended up moving down here during that summer to record at his place in Sherman Oaks. We recorded the entire album at Pat Leonard's studio at the time, Johnny Yuma, where he had a place over here in Burbank where he would record Madonna. So we were doing the basic tracks there, and then we did all the overdubs at his house. Mm-hmm. And then I joined Toy Matinee after that. Then I had to move down here.
Well, so, when you on White Noise, what did you use back then, and with the amp and the guitar?
I was using my Charvel, because I... I had just bought. When you buy guitars young, when you're young, you don't keep them. You don't have enough money to keep them. You have to trade up, right? So I started with an ES-335, nice Alvin Lee Special, right? Because I was a huge 10 Years After fan, and then I wasn't getting enough sustain, right? So I ended up getting a Les Paul. I saved all of my landscaping money that I used and bought a Les Paul. I get it for 3 days, and we're playing the place up there, and I hear Goodbye Pork Pie Hat coming over the break music, right, Jeff Beck. And I went, what the hell is that? What's he doing? Oh, that's a wobble arm. What's a wobble arm? Well, it's this thing you bend, you know. I was like, Jesus, my Les Paul doesn't have a wobble arm, you know. I went back to Leo's Music and sold the damn thing, and because I needed a wobble. It blew me away when I heard that sound. He was manipulating all these incredible things you can't do other than with a wobble arm. Yeah. He wasn't doing the ventures. He wasn't doing that. He was catching notes in between and bending up and blowing my mind. So I got a Charvel. And they wouldn't give it to me left-handed. They couldn't say we're not set up for it. We'll just give you the headpiece and the neck, and you have to put it together and build it. You know, so I had Gary Brower, who was up in the Bay Area up there, who's still up there, great guitarist and luthier, and he put the thing together for me. And my father drew a massive dragon on the front of it, which is on the Double E Ticket. Mm-hmm. And so I used that guitar through a Soldano. Mike Soldano was in town at the time, and so we garnered some amps from different places, and that was one of them. So I think that was through a Soldano, if I'm not mistaken.
That's a great sound. I mean,
yeah. Well, that's also Kevin Gilbert production too. You know, he was very bold in his production at that time. We had a lot of things dead quiet, no cheese on anything. You know, so says if you can play, you know.
So that was just straight. There was no effects.
No, there's no effects on any. We played a lot of stuff just dry.
And it had a lot of gain. Was that did the Charvel have
the Charvel's a monster. That thing still to this day.
You still have it?
Oh, yes. I stop selling my guitars. I can keep them now, because once you can afford them, they start giving them to you, which is completely sucks, because you know, I needed them. Where were you when I was struggling, you know? So
well, let's talk a little bit. I'm going to play a clip of that you gave us. It's it's actually kind of a little of exclusive clip from I guess of the you're doing a DVD of a tribute concert for Keith Emerson.
Yes.
Well, before I play it, I want to ask you something here, and we can play it, and then you can answer, because we were talking a little bit before the show. I remember, we all know Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, and how Greg Lake, his approach playing against what Keith was doing, because Keith was an amazing keyboardist, and he was doing all sorts of really, I mean, when you listen to the first three albums, it's all over the place with the Moog, with the piano. It's one of the best organ sounds ever. And there isn't a lot of room, and Greg Lake playing primarily bass, but he did do some guitar stuff, but he kept it very simple, and then also he was doing the songs. And I want to know your approach, because listening to you in the Keith Emerson Band, and you had the chops. I mean, not that Greg Lake wasn't a great guitarist, he was, but it was interesting where you found the places to play, because you're playing with him on some of the stuff, and this song Hoedown shows that. So let me play the clip, but I want to ask your approach to playing, because he's a complex player, and there's a lot happening there. There's not a lot of room, wiggle room, even for the wiggle arm, but there's not a lot of room in there for you to play. So this is Hoedown, and take a listen. You'll hear Keith playing. You'll hear the main organ part, which is the most famous part, but then a little bit later into the cut, you'll hear Mark playing with him, and he's like, they're playing along together, and it's amazing. It's just really good. Here we go. Really interesting how you integrated. You're playing some of the lines with him. You're actually doing some counterpoint stuff in there, and then still power chords. And it's interesting because it all fits, and it's not, it's very easy to get cluttered, and it isn't. And that to me is brilliant. So,
thank you.
Tell me a little bit about approaching that.
Well, with any, it doesn't matter what it is, any kind of music, you need to. Especially if you're guitar player, and I think the best example of that is Steve Howe. You listen to what he did in Yes, and he was hardly ever playing chords strumming unless it was on an acoustic. It was parts. And it's like an orchestra. It doesn't matter if a band is five-piece electric or if it's an orchestra, the same laws of music apply. You need to orchestrate. You need to listen. You need to know what's being played, when it has to be played, and when not to play. You know, there's nothing better than a well-played rest in the right area. So for this stuff, Keith always wanted a fourth guy. He always wanted, in ELP, he wanted a guitarist.
Well, there were rumors that he was jamming with Hendrix.
He did, and you know, and he also asked Steve, and he asked a couple of people. But and I got a really nice compliment from him later. He said, "If I'd known about you, you would have been in the band." But I don't think Belp would have gone over too well. So it was nice to hear that, though. But the point being that he always heard guitar in there, but couldn't find anyone that could facilitate what he was hearing. So when we got together to sit down to do these arrangements, it was great because he wanted to, because of what you said earlier, that he was carrying most of the weight. He really wanted to sit back and get into comping, get into like support parts and things that he could do behind. And so that's why I think we made a really good combination, because I could field a lot of that stuff because I grew up playing all that stuff. I didn't just cop guitar player licks. I copped his licks, too. I learned to play Tarkus when I was in high school.
Well, it's interesting because some of those things lay really well for keyboards, but they're not easy to play for guitar.
No.
And you're following some of that. And then you harmonize to it. You do like a double. That's cool.
Well, again, it's orchestration. It's knowing when to go with the main melody, when to play support, so that the guitar belongs there. You know, you're not playing chords. There's no reason for it. You know, you don't have to play chords as often as most, you know, guys that play chords. Like, you don't have to play them that often. And a lot of times, my old guitar instructor, jazz instructor, Warren Nunes, once said, if you're playing with a keyboardist, you know, back off. You don't need to play all of the notes. You got a keyboardist who's loading up the chords in the first place. Play your thirds and your sevens. Play your power tones. Those are the only things you need to play. And that way, it's like a laser beam. It's a thin line, but you get to hear it, but it doesn't clutter up anything. And you have to hear where your fidelity is coming from. If you got too much low end on the bottom, you know, you need to get up out of there. Get up out of the swamp. Find an area where it's not being occupied and use it. You know, exploit it. But it all comes down to one word, and that's listening. You really have to listen.
Yes.
And I find that a lot of players sometimes fall short in those areas where you, especially when you have two guitar players and they're playing the same thing together, it's like you don't need to do that. You can either not play and come in on a place where it makes it have meaning, have weight, so the other parts are in contrast. If everything is big, then nothing's big. So you need to be able to really orchestrate your stuff. And if you're playing low, have the other guy play high. Play something that's, again, it's like an orchestra. You need to listen where the piccolos are, where the flutes are, where the woodwinds.
Even.
Yeah, it's no different than the principles you apply to orchestra. It's the same thing to a band. Mm-hmm. And the best bands know that.
Well, like you were saying with Steve Howe, what would happen with him and Rick Wakeman is they actually would counterpoint.
Yes.
So they'd play against each other. And they could, and then there's Squire throwing in another thing, but it worked, and it was never a cacophony or a mess. It was always functional.
Absolutely,
you know. And did Keith tell you, like, could you put something in here? Would he suggest, or would he just let you go?
I think he kind of just let me go. I think the thing was good about this is we trusted each other really well. He knew I would always have his back. If there was something he couldn't play, you know, later on when his hand got to be a little bit more arduous to play, I said, let me comp that part. We are a four-piece band. Let's treat it as a four-piece. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times we came up with arrangements that were actually he liked better because the role got thrown around a little bit, you know, and was like, okay, you play this part, you know, that I normally played, and let me do this. I actually like that better. So I think being limited sometimes frees you in that aspect. And so because of that, he was extremely open. He had no ego at all and was extremely open to suggestion. And what if we do that? What if we do this? And then I would always raise and call the bet, you know, like, hey, that sounds good. As a matter of fact, let me try this on the synth or on the Moog to do it this way or whatever. It was a very healthy, creative relationship that we had. So, you know.
Well, I'm going to play another clip. This is from Boys Club Live, which was with Keith. And this is one of your songs. It's called Afterburner. And it's interesting because you were talking about he liked the comp. Would he normally just go for the Hammond or would he go for the piano?
It really depended on what the mood of the song was, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he comped better on the piano because that was really his instrument, you know. I mean, that's what he started with, was piano. And he was basically at heart a jazz pianist. That's what he loved the best. And I think organ and Moog came later because he wanted to replicate the orchestra that he was hearing in his head that he wasn't able to afford, And so, but it all got conceived on piano. And Enigma, Tarkus, all those were on piano to begin with.
And it's interesting because Copeland had heard all of his stuff and loved what he was doing. Which I think is a great compliment to what he was up to.
Absolutely.
Let me play Afterburner a little bit, and we can talk a little more about that. Interesting there. I see you're using the wobble arm.
Yes.
Now, was that the Charvel?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
Okay. Yeah.
And I got to give my props to my boys, too, in the band. You had Bob Birch on bass, also Mick Mahan on bass, Joe Travers on drums, Ed Roth on keys as well, and also Mike Wallace playing that hellacious chug underneath it, too. These guys were just the biggest pleasure to play with.
Now, how was that? What was the? How did that get together? How did you put?
Well,
where did this come about?
The first touring band for Doubly Ticket was Mike Keneally, Tos Panos, Dave Marino, and myself. Mm-hmm. And then Mike Keneally left to join. I think he was going to join Steve Vai.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to get two people to replace Mike Keneally, like you always do, because he would be playing keyboards with one hand, and he's a mutant, you know? He plays the guitar with the other hand. So I got Ed Roth, and I got Mike Wallace, both on the first roll of the dice, and they're great players, and we still play together. I mean, all these guys I still play with. I play with every single one of them still.
Yeah, that Boys Club Live, it's a live album. That was live, and it's great. What amp were you using?
I was using a... at the time, I was using my Yamaha. It was a Yamaha T100, which was designed by Mike Soldano. So I was using that, and then using my Charvel and my green Pacifica that I got when I was in Toy Matinee.
Oh, wow. I didn't know Soldano designed
that. He designed an amp.
That was a tube amp or something?
It was a tube amp, yeah, yeah. So I would have two amps. I had one of them, I think, I had a three cabinets. The middle one was the normal sound, and then I would spit it out to a clean amp for the effects, and then I would have the effects coming out stereo, so mm-hmm. three mics on it. And it was a big sound.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole album is huge.
Yeah, it is.
But there's a lot, and again, those changes and stuff. You can hear the prog influence because you're doing
all these.
But you're kind of funking it up a little bit. It has like a great groove.
Well,
to
my wife, Joey, loves funk. She says that's her best music. She likes the funk and the rock stuff. So when you do the funk stuff, I'm there, you know, so I have to do that for her.
Well, speaking of funk, I'm going to play a couple of clips from another band that you've been playing with, California Transit Authority, with Danny Seraphim. That's a whole different groove, and it kind of just shows your versatility and be able to play in a lot of different situations. Let me play a clip. This is called Sacred Ground from that title album. And tell us a little bit, and then we'll talk a little more about that group playing in that and what the challenges in there.
All right.
Now, that, there's some great horn runs.
Yes,
there. Gorgeous.
Now, you were talking about listening to other instruments. Obviously, you're playing, you weren't playing chords there.
No. Well, I did the horn arrangements for that.
Because, oh, wow.
Because I, and see, that's one of the reasons that I haven't gotten back to doing a guitar solo album till now, because I wanted to challenge myself in different areas. I didn't want to stay in one area and do another album if I didn't explore some other things. And so, that was one of the reasons I got into sound, TV and soundtrack music. You know, it was an opportunity to do it, and it was something I'd never done. So it's like, that's a good reason to do it. And the same thing with the orchestra stuff and with meeting Danny and forming CTA with this album, Sacred Ground. It was all new material. So I sat and I listened to the Chicago stuff and really took it apart. What makes it work as well as it does? And then sat down and started doing brass arrangements, that being one of them, you know. And it's like, well, this sounds like Chicago, you know. But you don't, if you don't test yourself, you don't know what you're capable of.
Right.
And you might as well go out in the water and far enough where your feet don't hit the ground. You know, that's a good place to always be, like David Bowie said. You know? And it's good. You got to scare yourself every day. It's a good place to push yourself.
Well, those brass riffs are just killer. But also, you're playing in and out of them. It's different than you would, you know. It's different than what I've seen other. Well, Chicago, when Terry was there and the other guitarists that played, they don't play like that.
Yeah. Well, everybody has their own style, you know. For me, I'm always listening to all the instruments. What can I contribute? If I can't contribute anything else, I won't play. To me, some of my best playing is me shutting up.
Right.
You know, because it's one of those things where it doesn't need anything.
Well, you're just like playing another horn part.
Yeah, pretty much.
The only thing I can think of off the top of my head was recently we had Carmen Grillo on the show.
Yeah.
And he did his solo album with some brass stuff, and the same thing. He was doing another line.
Yeah.
He was blending in with it as opposed to...
Yeah. No, there's all different types of colors you can use. Depends on what flavors you want to blend, you know. It depends on what the tune calls for. We got to remember that none of us are greater than the song. All of us are servants of the song.
Right.
And when any player thinks that the music is serving them, that's an issue. At least it is for me. I won't play with anybody like that. Everybody, I don't care who you are, and the greatest players on earth will know that mountain that they're climbing will never be smaller than, you know, will never be, they'll always be smaller than that. And you're always a servant. You have to go, what fits the tune, not what fits my ego or what fits my endorsers. It's what works for the song.
Well, that's the key, what you were saying before, listening to the rest of the players. Then you figure out what you're going to do.
Or what you're not going to do.
And when you have people like Keith Emerson that are just virtuoso players, you know, you don't need to do
it. No, you don't.
Let them go.
I remember was a great famous director who got the Lifetime Achievement Award at the Oscars. And he said, what's the secret to your success? And he says, I hired the best people in the business and I got out of their way.
Yeah.
And that's exactly it. Get out of their way. They know what they're doing. You know.
Well, I'm going to play another clip from CTA and a different feel, but it's a very cool thing. And especially it's the guitar on it's great. This is called South California Purples. So let me play this clip and we'll talk a little about what you were doing here. We'll be right back. best rhythm sections ever.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Who is playing organ?
Ed Roth.
Oh, okay.
But Keith also came in and played "I'm a Man" on that.
Very cool.
Yes,
because that the way.
That's Ed Roth. He's a master on the organ.
He's great.
Yeah,
no,
and that's from this is called Full Circle, that album, and the other one, Sacred Ground.
Yeah.
I recommend these. They're really, if you like a really good groove, the whole album's like that. And that just the punch. I mean, it hits you in the chest. Yeah. I mean, I'm hearing through headphones, but I'm feeling in the chest. It's just a great, great sound. Now, what were you using there?
That was using my Pacifica Green, and it threw a Marshall JCM 2000 on that, and that was me just ripping off Johnny Winter. I'm a huge Johnny Winter fan, so that was just me doing my Johnny Winter impression, really. You know, I mean, there's double stops and there's things that try to mix it up.
I was feeling a little Hendrix there.
Well, yeah, of course there is. There's always going to be Jimmy in my essence there. You know, but also if you'll notice, and there's a rip in there from Allman Brothers. You Don't Love Me. I kind of tipped the hat to the Allman Brothers too. You know,
now you that's just you the guitar and the amp. No processing.
No processing at all.
Oh, that's a great tone. Each song that I've been playing, your sound, it's different tones.
Yeah. I mean, on the new album, I'm going through a lot more colors and stuff because it's more atmospheric. You know, there's playing. It's constant guitars going through it, but it's more atmospheric and a lot more tonals and sonic paintings and stuff of that nature to some pretty heavy stuff. But
well, let's talk a little bit about this upcoming album, and I have the pleasure of playing some sneak peeks of it, so we'll play a little bit of that in a minute. But tell us a little bit what you're trying to do now on this one.
Well, it's taken me 25 years, like I said, because of all of these other projects.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really feel that it was warranted for me to do another guitar instrumental album. I mean, people have been asking, when are you going to do another one? When are you going to do another one? You know. But I kind of gave into that finally because I figured, well, for the past 25 years, I've gone through a lot of different terrain, musical terrain. And now I have something to say as far as here's where I've been. And it's a deeply personal album. I've got a lot of the subject matter in it is personal for me. And I've got a lot of the last performances. I got Keith's last performance on it on keyboards. I got Bob Birch's last bass performance on it. So there's a lot of emotional attachment to it, you know, these things. There's a song about my son on this album, which is something I'd always wanted to write but never felt the right thing yet, you know. And so it's really kind of a retrospective of where I've been over the past 25 years. I mean, all these new branches that have grown onto the tree, but the thing is that the branches aren't going to grow if the roots aren't good.
So
you need to go back to your roots, you know, and I've paid tribute to a lot of that on there. I've got some great friends that have come in to volunteer their abilities on the album, so I'm very, very happy that Greg Bissonette's going to be on it, Joe Travers, Troy Laquetta, Philippe Seiss from Al Camilla's band, Jordan Rudess is going to be on it, Eddie Jobson's going to be on it, so there's a lot of...
Everybody from the tribute concert.
Pretty much, a lot of people from, you know, yeah, so it's, you know, so it's, again, it's going to go through a lot of different changes and stuff.
Now these are not the final mixes. He drew some mixes for us so that we could play it on the show tonight, and I'm very grateful for that. I'm going to play this first cut, Sailor Ruff, and I edited two pieces together so you can hear what he's doing. There's some beautiful guitar work
on
it.
What Sailor is, by the way, is that I was a huge 10cc fan, and this is from Godley and Cream's first album called Consequences, which is an album that a lot of people don't even know about. It's a three-album set that was designed to profile the Gizmotron.
Yes.
It got out of hand, and they turned it into a three-album set. But this was one of the beautiful songs was on this album called Sailor. It was very much like Summertime by Gershwin. So I've kind of gone beyond that, though. But that's where this song comes from.
Okay, so it's called Sailor. The file said Rough, I just assumed. Okay, let me play this, and you got check out what he's doing with, there's several layers of guitars in here, and then we'll go into more detail. But besides playing regular guitar, he's doing some beautiful slide work on here. So let me play the clip. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot going on in there. I love those slide guitars that you're playing in the background. Yeah. And then we were talking a little bit before the show. There's a Leslie guitar.
Yes, that was Luke over at Keyboard Concepts over in Burbank designed this great Leslie cabinet for guitar. It's just, it's amazing. So I can't get enough of that sound, but I used it judiciously on the album. But this is one of the places.
Do you use it live?
Yes, I've used it live, yeah. It sounds amazing.
It's it's panning, so it's like just all over.
There's nothing like wood, you know. I mean, there's nothing like real manipulation of air, you know. And you can't get it on a simulator. You just can't. So there's a lot of that in there. There's an Ebow in there on the background. There's slide.
Is that that sustain note that's playing against you?
Yes, it's slide with an Ebow. So that's what that is. And then there's the actual slide in there, and then there's I'm playing Strat on the opening part of that. I think that's all Strat until it kicks in, and then that's Pacific.
And that opening is that bass or is that a?
Yes, there's a bass.
The very beginning.
Yeah, there's a bass in there too. There's a lot of, like I said, there's guitar. There's
and you're playing the bass on that?
I'm playing everything on that right at that point.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, everything's
So what kind of bass?
It's a Yamaha Attitude bass is one of them. I play Hofner bass on some of the stuff. Fender Precision on some.
That's a great sound. That bass is nice.
Yeah,
that's a really interesting
great sound. It's a Yamaha.
It's almost like a tenor guitar type part, you know, it kind of works like that.
Well, again, it has a lot of clarity on the top, and so a lot of times I'll be using the bass for a guitar part, you know, because it has more weight and heft because of the string. So it all depends on what it calls for.
And at the very end, who is playing keyboards?
That's me.
Oh, wow. You're doing everything.
I'm doing everything on that.
So you're doing the keyboard. You're doing pretty good.
Well, I can make people think I can play this.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was the comping. Was
great. Well, yeah. I when you're by yourself, right, you end up doing things by yourself.
Yeah.
And that's how I create most of the time in my studio by myself. I'm uninterrupted and just, you know, what does this need?
That's great that you're doing all the parts.
Well, on that tune, I am. You know, I have Jim Gammon, who is a lifelong friend, who's doing trumpet on that song because I cannot play trumpet. But I still have a lot of help on the album on different pieces. But a lot of I'm playing mostly the bass on there.
Well, I'm going to play another clip of that, and this is another edit I put together. This is called Flesh Wound.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about it, and then I'll play it.
Well, this was kind of a song about there's a lot of violence on the album, actually. A lot of commentary about violence. And just about its escalation over the years and how I've seen it, you know, become tabloid news, basically. And this is a tune that opens up with an incident that happened. There's segs in between all this stuff, so it sets up kind of so this tune is kind of about that. It's you know, it's a very aggressive song, you know, kind of about.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and play it. It's a great tune. Here you go. Here's Flesh Wound.
Thank you.
Well, I told you it'd go by real fast. We're already out of time. We're gonna have we're gonna play a clip, and Mark is gonna play with it from his second album, American Matador, with the orchestra. But before we do that, let's talk about some of the upcoming events that are coming. There's some important things that we should mention.
Well, yeah, like I said, the release of the Keith Emerson official concert DVD will be coming out at some point during this year. I'm not sure exactly when. We're still in negotiations about all that. And this new instrumental album called Celluloid Debris will be out at some point as well. We're in the middle of...
That's the title?
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that'll be happening.
Can I also mention that my best friend did the artwork for
Yes, Jerry Lofaro rocked the
Jerry,
cover.
Jerry, you're listening, and you're probably jumping off your roof right now.
Yeah, like, no, it's
out.
Great. It's
Kathleen,
it's,
too.
Yeah, it's a reenactment of Tarkus and hyperrealism.
Yeah.
Yes, I saw.
We've got the magazine here. We'll put it in the pictures for
Absolutely.
The show.
Absolutely. Deserves to be on the front cover. Yeah, it's an amazing picture.
Incredible.
Well, we're just going to have you come back when that album is out.
Yeah.
Because I'd love to go through. And it's interesting hearing these early mixes and then finally hearing the final product. So you have to come back. There's no way I could do a show with you in one show. There's no way. There's so much to talk about.
So, well, this is American Matador. This was off the second album, but we redid it on the Three Fates project with Munich Symphony, Keith and I. And so... We're doing this as a tribute to him in Birmingham on July 28th. So anybody that happens to be over in England, that's where we're going to be. Rick Wakeman's going to be there. There's going to be a lot of people.
Which orchestra?
This will be the Birmingham Symphony at this point. But we will be doing this one over there.
Oh, this is great. Well, I want to thank you again for being on the show. And your lovely wife, Joey, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Keep the funk. Keep the funk. Because what he's doing on there. And then, Lori, thank you again for being here.
Thank you. Awesome. Awesome show. Thank you, Mark, for trusting me and coming
on the show.
Absolutely.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I love having a bunch of people in here.
Okay. Everybody have a great week. And this is American Matador.